Thank you for contributing to the show. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our top stories this hour. Iran says it has arrested dozens of terrorists as well as several nationals of European countries during the recent riots in the country. Russian President Vladimir Putin signs decrees paving the way for 4 Ukrainian regions to join Russia. Also, North Korea conducts 4th missile test in a week in the wake of the U.S. Vice President's visit to the region and joint military drills by South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. Thank you for joining us. Iran's intelligence ministry says 9 foreign nationals have been arrested for their role in recent riots in the country. The ministry says the detainees are from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, and other countries. It said they were either present in the riots or plotting behind the scenes. The ministry said the U.S. and the U.K. were directly involved in stirring up the unrest. It added that scores of MKO terrorists, as well as mercenaries belonging to Zionist groups, were also detained. The ministry noted that 36 kilograms of explosives were also seized from Takfiri terrorist groups planning to exploit the unrest and detonate them in public areas. The riots in Iran broke out after the death of a woman in hospital days after she collapsed at a police station. Iran's police have dismissed allegations of physical violence against 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. Political commentator Firas An-Najm says the U.S. and its allies are exploiting the death of Mahsa Amini to advance their anti-Iran agenda.
This whole issue right now, what's happening with Mahsa Amini and this problem that's happening inside Iran, you know, we know that the U.S. and their allies are exploiting this to the highest level and trying to infiltrate and trying to cause destabilization inside Iran. They are trying to weaken Iran because they have tried many ways for many years to damage the system, to try to, you know, take the system down, and they failed miserably. And all the Iranian people should stand against this and condemn this and should, understand that the unity of Iran and the strength of Iran is that there's no such terror attacks. But now that the U.S. has got involved and their little puppets, such as the MKO, that also have a very, very long history of crimes and treacherous acts and working with Saddam and also committing terrorist attacks inside Iran.
A terror attack that targeted a police station in the southeastern Iranian city of Zahedan on Friday has killed at least 19 people and injured 20 others. Zahedan's provincial governor says security forces are among the casualties. The deaths include two senior provincial commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC has blamed the so-called Jaish al-Adl terror group for the armed assault. It saw a large number of terrorists try to break into a police station shortly after Friday prayers, but officers warded off the attackers. Gunmen also attacked two other police stations and some other public places. Zahedan is the provincial capital of Sistan and Balochistan province, which has seen a number of attacks by terrorist groups mostly based in neighboring Pakistan over the past years. Iran's military has warned that it will retaliate if U.S. claims of downing an Iranian drone in the Iraqi Kurdistan region are confirmed. The chief of staff of Iranian armed forces says it reserves the right to counter and avenge the hostile move and will deliver the response in due time. Major General Mohammad Bogheri added that the U.S. claim shows that it is in cahoots with terrorists and separatists. Bogheri said Iran is currently engaged in a harsh military campaign against separatists and terrorists in northern Iraq and is not conducting any operation against Americans at this point. He stressed, however, that Iran has full intelligence command over U.S. military bases in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. A suicide attack at an education center in Afghanistan has left at least 20 people dead. Over two dozen have also been injured. No group has so far claimed responsibility. Earlier in our news review program, we took a closer look at the security situation in Afghanistan. Let's take a listen.
Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Abdullah Mirzadeh, who's joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Also, we have Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shahjadeh, who's joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Abdullah in Kabul, if you can. Please give us and our viewers an update on the situation and any further developments that you have to share with us.
Hello, gentlemen. As you know, around 7:30 today, by local time in Kabul, there was an explosion in an education center in a very crowded class. First, I need to give you some details on this Khaj education center. The new name is Khaj. This education center was known as Mosul years ago. 4 years ago, it was targeted another time. Maybe 50 students lost their lives. They changed their name, and through the name of Khaj, they started their activity again. Unfortunately, today, another explosion, another attacker, a suicide attacker, managed to get into the class and detonate his fist. The story, as we have understood up to now, is that a suicide attacker first attack to the guards. He killed two guards outside the educational center and moved on his way, went through two other people and he injured them. Then he went to the class where a mock test for entrance exam was being taken from the students. The population in the class is estimated to be 400 people. Those classes here in Afghanistan, unfortunately, are very crowded. And the girls were sitting in front of the class because for the new policies of the Taliban, the classes are divided into two parts, male and female. Generally, the female ones sit in front of the class. The attacker, as he enters the class, he actually maybe sees that the situation is good right now, so he detonates his fist. Most of those who have lost their lives are girls and women. The number of casualties was officially estimated by the Taliban. 19 people have lost their lives and 27 people were injured. After that, the Ministry of Public Health said that 23 people have lost their lives. And maybe hours ago, there is another unofficial, I could say, because no Taliban have actually approved that, an unofficial figure says that 30 girls have lost their lives, but there might be males. We do not yet know if 30 is an exact number or not. We do not know which one we could rely on the most, the official one, 19 and 27. So we must wait on that. As you know, this attack has happened while most and majority of the people in that area, in Barachi area, are Shia Muslims. And this attack is maybe, we could say, fourth or fifth attack in the last 2 months,
right,
maybe, that happened in that area.
All right, let's bring in Masoud Shajad, who's with us from the British capital, London. Mr. Shajad, give us your thoughts on the overall security situation in Afghanistan right now and about the attack that Abdullah was just elaborating on. What are the motives of such attacks, in your opinion?
Well, it's quite obvious that the motives are to create a complete chaos and put further pressure and sort of give the impression that Afghanistan is unmanageable. And this, unfortunately, is the sort of result of many years of destruction of the infrastructures and battering that Afghanistan had under the occupation of the Western occupation led by United States. And we are seeing that the coordinated effort to undermine the present government and the finances and the money of the Afghanistan is taken away, sanctions, and indeed this sort of chaos and terrorism being unleashed on Afghanistan. I have to say that one of the things that worries me is a trend that seems to be that we internationally seem to care for some lives more than others. So, you know, when it comes to European white lives in Ukraine, they are valued at the top of the scale. And then when it comes to Afghanistan and elsewhere, then becomes totally unvalued. Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, Palestine. So really, you have to be pro-Western sort of individual for your life to be valued. And I think this is an unfortunate situation which creates a hierarchical structure for human life and human rights. And as long as we continue this, we'll see that further demolishing of the human rights and human life value in places like Afghanistan. And the international community just turns a blind eye to it, because it's not the present government in Afghanistan is not progressed. So, so the value of the lives of people under the control, it really is non-existent. This is something that the international community has to address.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Masoud Shajad, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. And also thanks to correspondent in Kabul, Abdullah Amirzadeh. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree for the formal accession of four Ukrainian regions of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk. In a speech at the Kremlin, Putin said people in the four regions have become Russian citizens forever. More in this report.
For many years, the people of Donbas have been waiting for this historic day, which was preceded by a bloody war in the east of Ukraine that led to the intervention of the Russian army to save the Lugansk and Donetsk people from genocide. Despite Western pressure, the Russian president did not hesitate to accept the request of four regions of eastern Ukraine to join the Federation through a referendum described as successful by authorities in those regions. Central Election Committee representatives reported that those who took part in the votes decided overwhelmingly in favor of the accession to Russia.
The unbroken people of Donbas, Zaporizhia and Kherson said the word. I want the authorities in Kyiv and the real masters in the West to hear me, and I want everyone to remember this. People living in DPR, LPR, Kherson and Zaporizhia have become our citizens forever.
In a ceremony attended by the heads of Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson and Zaporozhye regions, Vladimir Putin signed a decree for the formal accession of the former Ukrainian territories controlled by the Russian army over the past months. As a result, the four regions became part of the Russian Federation, which is now obliged to protect them from any aggression under the constitution and the Russian military doctrine.
Today we are fighting for a just and free path. First of all, for ourselves, for Russia, for diktat, despotism to remain forever in the past. I am convinced that countries and peoples understand that a policy based on exclusivity of anyone, on the suppression of other cultures and peoples, is inherently criminal, that we must turn this shameful page. The collapse of Western hegemony that has begun is irreversible. And I repeat again, it will not be the same as before.
Our country is taking back its historical lands that our grandfathers defended. I am inspired that I caught and I am a participant of this moment. These territories and our people were artificially divided.
The West, led by the United States, has been supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine, sending large numbers of mercenaries to the country, and imposing huge economic sanctions against Russia. But it has failed to stop Moscow's special military operation in Ukraine. And for the Donbas, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, which have been fighting for their right to become part of Russia, the accession means, first of all, security and sustainable economic development for them.
The right and decision of the four regions to join Russia is undoubtedly a historical moment. Moscow says strikes by Ukraine on those territories joining Russia today will be seen as an act of aggression against the state. It has vowed to protect the territories at all cost after their accession to Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
South Korea and Japan say North Korea has fired two ballistic missiles in its fourth test launch this week. The South Korean Chiefs of Staff says the missiles were fired towards the country's east coast. The launches came after South Korea, the U.S., and Japan staged trilateral anti-submarine drills for the first time in 5 years. Days earlier, the navies of the U.S. and South Korea also conducted large-scale drills off the Korean Peninsula. North Korea sees such military exercises as rehearsals for an invasion. The Friday's missile tests also followed a visit by the U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris to South Korea this week. Pyongyang has increased such tests this year. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah,
words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Puerto Rico is suffering from the consequences of another major hurricane. Hurricane Fiona brings the experiences of the past with itself: weak infrastructure, discrimination, and inequality in Puerto Rico. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to Politico, Puerto Ricans living on the island frequently deal with the possibility of losing power, regardless of whether or not a storm is passing through. In April, an island-wide blackout caused by a possible equipment failure knocked out power to parts of the island for 5 days. The unplanned outages posed threats to equipment essential for businesses and hospitals, including the refrigerators people need to store their daily medications, such as insulin used by diabetes. And drinking water has been disrupted to two-thirds of people living on the island, at least partly due to the lack of electricity and flooding that has overrun the systems. Leah Fuel Mata, senior counsel at Latino Justice, an organization that advocates for decolonization of the island, said, "Life on the island is becoming unsustainable, but at the same time, people are there fighting for things to get better." On the inequality and discrimination in Puerto Rico, the Washington Post wrote, "For much of the post-war era, America's territories thrived. Remnants of the age of imperialism, the five far-flung Caribbean and Pacific outposts added residents faster than most states, but the 2020 census revealed a troubling turn. Every territory is now shrinking, losing population faster than any state. The largest U.S. territory, Puerto Rico, has 3.3 million people and Spanish and West Indian traditions tracing back to Columbus. The nearby U.S. Virgin Islands were previously settled by Denmark over the Pacific between Japan and Australia, Guam and Northern Mariana Islands share Chamorro heritage and tourist economies oriented toward East Asia. An American Samoa in the heart of Polynesia still employs a communal system of land ownership and lies closer to New Zealand than Hawaii. One big thing unites them, U.S. rule. Their population collapse also seems uniquely American. From 2010 to 2020, the population plummeted by 18% in the U.S. Virgin Islands, while the British Virgin Islands gained 9%. Over the same period, American Samoa lost 11%, while Independent Samoa gained 7%. What's going on? Why are people fleeing the distant vestiges of America's global empire? Good data remains elusive. The government rarely gives the territories equal coverage in its headline economic and demographic releases. Legislation introduced in July by Representative Raul May Grijalva and territories' non-voting delegates would push agencies to fill those data gaps, but it has yet to truly begin the arduous journey through Congress. So, we picked up the phone talking with locals, officials, and experts over the past few months. We eventually came to a simple, perhaps overly simple conclusion, the Washington Post reporter said, adding, "The island territories, even the most developed ones, have much in common with America's rural areas. The problems are rural problems, supercharged by migration and tax policy, and of course, by distance from the nation's population centers. The population loss in the territories came as rural America snapped a four-decade population growth streak and started shrinking. The decline stemmed from familiar rural culprits. Declining manufacturing, lack of healthcare, falling birth rights, burn drain, and climate change. Even Puerto Rico's storied capital, San Juan, might have more in common with a faded Rust Belt hub like Detroit than with a coastal superstar city. Like many rural areas, the islands are trapped in a vicious cycle. As people lose their jobs or move away, tax revenue falls. Without that revenue, the territories can't provide the same services. The lack of services and amenities drives more residents away. Those residents stop paying taxes and the cycle accelerates. But what set off the cycle? What turned decades of growth into decline? Each island is different. But when reporters asked for the broadest factors, economists pointed to manufacturing. The Washington Post added, "The economic struggles have accelerated brain drain on the islands as the young and ambitious leave to attend a school or join the U.S. military. As with rural kids seeking their fortune in cities, the islanders often put down roots on the mainland, where their college degrees and other experience are far more remunerative. The islands just don't have many high-paying opportunities for the educated. It's really troubling for our middle class and our students who graduate here," said Rosen Jones, a University of Guam economist who has spent past 25 years on the island, adding, They're beginning to say this is a very challenging place economically to build and raise a family to commit to.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Queen and the Royal Family.
Part 2.
The UK has both historically and contemporaneously prided itself on its tradition of open wills, whereby wills are open to inspection by the public, mostly out of concern to prevent theft and abuse of authority. And yet the royal family has dissented from this long-established national practice by their ability, since 1910, to seal their wills. The untimely death in 1910 of errant Prince Francis, the brother-in-law of King George V, set in stone a tradition which the British royal family jealously guards to this day, the concept and practice of sealed wills. The catalyst for the un-British practice of sealed wills was Prince Francis' erratic, if not reckless, lifestyle, best exemplified by his compulsive gambling and extreme womanizing. In his will, Francis is believed to have left priceless family jewels to one of his more flamboyant mistresses, Ellen Constance, the Countess of Kilmery, with whom he was rumored to have had an illegitimate child. This significant act of indiscretion and breach of protocol spurred the royal family into action, first by suppressing the will and subsequently reaching out to Ellen Constance with a hefty bribe, £10,000 to be exact, which amounts to £700,000 in today's money. For the past 100 years or so, English courts have upheld the monarchy's demand that wills of its members, in stark contrast to the wills of the general public, should be sealed and, in effect, kept secret in perpetuity. On the few occasions when this self-declared right to secrecy has been challenged in the courts, notably in 2006 by one Robert Brown, who claims he is an illegitimate child of the deceased Princess Margaret, this has been quashed by the Queen's judges. The precedent set by the suppression of the will of Prince Francis, above all, demonstrates that the British legal system, rooted firmly in the principles of English law, never flinches when it comes to accommodating the whims and fancies of the monarchy. This was in evidence, most recently, in the aftermath of the demise of Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Loyne, also known as the Queen Mother, who died in March 2002.
A mother, a mum, the Queen Mum.
In keeping with royal tradition, established in 1910 in the wake of Prince Francis's demise, the Queen Mother's will was sealed up on the orders of the High Court, which means that on present trajectory, in view of the total hegemony of the monarchy, it is closed to inspection and publication in perpetuity. The blanket secrecy surrounding royal wills is central to the secrecy in which they conduct all their personal affairs. From wealth accumulation to the conduct of sordid affairs and other scandalous relationships, the case of Diana's husband, Prince Charles, speaks volumes. Diana's husband and her heir to the throne, who is no stranger to sordid and secret affairs. Charles's most infamous escapades was with his childhood sweetheart, Camilla Parker Bowles, with whom he started a secret affair in 1986, 5 years after his marriage with Diana. This is the same Prince Charles whose love for hunting animals is equal to, if not excessive of, his love for human flesh. An avid fox hunter, Charles once famously said he would not stop hunting foxes in the British countryside until the practice was made illegal. Fox hunting was made illegal in the UK in November 2004, and while it is not known if Prince Charles partakes in these illegal hunts, it is well known that for years he lobbied former Prime Minister Tony Blair to repeal the ban. By all credible accounts, Charles's brother Andrew is more morally compromised, as evidenced by his long-standing relationship with the deceased American pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew, or the Duke of York to use his formal title, is the quintessential royal playboy, as demonstrated by his long list of romantic entanglements, even after his ill-fated marriage to Sarah Ferguson in 1986. Beginning in 1980, the Duke of York has conducted affairs with an astonishing number of glamorous women, including the former playboy model Courtney Love, reality TV star Caroline Stanbury, and the American photographer and actress Koo Stark. Andrew's wife of 10 years, the notoriously volatile Sarah Ferguson, was also no stranger to scandal and sordid affairs. Her immoral and carefree lifestyle exploded onto the public domain after photos of her lounging by the pool with her financial advisor, the Texan millionaire John Bryan, kissing and sucking her toes, were published. However, what the British public sees in the way of royal scandals, which erupt onto the public sphere from time to time, is merely the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Plenty of dodgy dealings take place behind the scenes, which the public never hears about, as the monarchy's ironclad secrecy, enforced by the courts and broader machinery of state, shows no sign of relenting. The British monarchy exerts influence from behind the scenes, in a carefully choreographed effort to present the British system as a parliamentary democracy, with minimal interference in the nation's day-to-day affairs by the Queen. But like everything else in modern Britain, appearances can be deceptive. Even the most intrinsic feature of modern government, namely legislation. On the surface, the process of legislation in the UK is undertaken by both the Houses of Parliament and the government of the day, playing a central role in introducing proposed legislation in the form of bills. But the monarch plays an influential role both at the beginning and end of the legislative process through the Queen's consent and assent. With the former signifying the sovereign's agreement with parliamentary debate on a proposed piece of legislation, and the latter marking the sovereign's seal of approval to a bill that has successfully completed the parliamentary process.
Grateful, and I think my views on this are pretty well understood.
Indeed, a bill only becomes an act or law of the land once it has been granted royal assent by the Queen. It might be argued that none of this dissents in a fundamental way from the principles of constitutional monarchy insofar as the sovereign is expected to play a symbolic role in the legislative process. But nothing could be further from the truth. As the Queen actively employs her power of withholding consent for proposed legislation, often in concert with and the active collusion of a sitting government. This often occurs when a sitting government wants to stop proposed legislation which originates from the inner circles of policymaking. Therefore, briefing the Queen and persuading her to withhold her consent from the bill, to be even discussed in Parliament, is the most effective way of stopping inconvenient proposed legislation in its tracks. In keeping with the British tradition of secrecy, records are not kept as to how many times the Queen has exercised her power to withhold consent from proposed legislation entering the parliamentary fray.
In the House of Peers.
But the public know of at least three occasions. The Titles Bill, 1964. The Rhodesia Independence Bill, 1969. And the Military Action Against Iraq Bill, 1999. On all three occasions, the bills were proposed by backbenchers in the House of Commons, and on all three occasions, the sitting government quashed the initiative by way of persuading the Queen to intervene.
Her attack on the BBC.
In fact, whereas the UK is continually at pains to project itself as the world's leading parliamentary democracy, with Parliament supposedly acting as the will of the people, the truth is that an unelected sovereign plays a central role in the legislative process, both in passive and active capacities. In February 2021, The Guardian revealed that more than 1,000 laws have been vetted by the Queen or Prince Charles through a secretive procedure before they were approved by the UK's elected members of Parliament. The huge number of laws subject to royal vetting cover matters ranging from justice, social security, pensions, race relations, and food policy, through to obscure rules on car parking charges and hovercraft. The wealth of the royal family in terms of fixed assets is concentrated in two crown bodies, the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Lancaster is by far the most consequential, as it constitutes the private estate of the sovereign Queen Elizabeth II. The Duchy of Cornwall, meanwhile, belongs to the eldest son of the reigning monarch, which currently is Prince Charles. These holdings, or crown bodies, to use British political jargon, merely represents the vast estates, including palaces, that belong to the royal family and which the state upkeeps with taxpayers' money. But the Queen's wealth, as well as other leading members of the royal family, exceeds the value of the buildings and lands held by the two duchies. As far back as 2001, the Mail on Sunday calculated that the Queen was worth £1.15 billion, with her vast investment portfolio worth £500 million alone. The Queen reportedly is an avid collector of expensive and exotic items. Her collection alone was worth an eye-watering £100 million. But as faithful as he was to the pertinent facts, Hall's description was, by all credible accounts, an underestimate. In 2017, the Paradise Paper leak revealed that millions of pounds from the private estate of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II had been invested in offshore tax haven funds. The royal family doesn't have to pay a single penny for the upkeep of the vast estates under their control. And needless to say, members of the royal household don't pay a single penny in income tax either, or any other form of tax, for that matter. And that's just the beginning, as the royal family receives a more than generous stipend from the state to maintain their lavish lifestyles, all at the expense of the out-of-pocket British taxpayer. The current legislative framework for funding the lifestyle and expenses of the royal family is embodied in the Sovereign Grant Act 2011, which replaced the civil list mechanism established by King George III in 1760. On the face of it, the new arrangement is advantageous to the monarchy, as income from the old civil list in the years 2001 to 2011 was fixed at £7.9 million annually. By contrast, in 2012, The new sovereign grant scheme funneled an exorbitant £1 million into the pockets of the royal household. In the year 2018 to 2019, this had increased to a staggering £82.8 million. And by all accounts, it is set to rise by at least 8 to 10% annually for the foreseeable future. To place financial arrangements on a more favourable footing, the royals could always rely on the Tory party, which had for the past 180 years, since its foundation in the 1830s, championed the cause of monarchy as part of its broader right-wing political and ideological agenda.
If Parliament were a school.
When the Conservative Party came to power following the May 2010 general election, albeit as part of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, they quickly set about abolishing the civil list arrangement of 1760. The then Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, contrived a scheme, doubtless in close consultation with the Queen and her son Prince Charles, which would replace the 1760 deal with a new arrangement whereby a percentage of the profits of the Crown estate would be diverted to royal accounts. This was initially set at 15% of profits annually, but has subsequently been increased to 25% to cover a bells and whistles upgrade to Buckingham Palace. Osborne and the Tories went the extra mile to please the Queen and her eldest son. For, as part of the new deal, if income from the Crown estates fell one year, the royals would be compensated for the loss. And vice versa, in the event of above-inflation income stream, the royals get to pocket the excess. The arrangement of 2011 has all the trappings of placing the royal family above the vicissitudes of the British economy. Despite its massive constitutional significance and considerable financial implications, information about this new arrangement was kept to a small circle within the government. It was rushed through a small committee in the House of Commons, with only the Scottish National Party objecting to its terms.
This is almost the kind of behaviour we would expect to see in the Duma in Moscow.
To make matters worse, the draft legislation was personally delivered to Prince Charles by the pliant Tory Chancellor Osborne so that the Queen's eldest son could issue his consent to the proposed legislation. Britain is not an anomaly in Europe in terms of having a monarchy. Excluding the UK, there are 9 monarchies left in Europe. But what sets the European monarchies apart from Britain's royal family is their genuine and robust constitutional status, in addition to multiple layers of oversight exercised over them to prevent abuse of power and privilege. For example, under Article 19 of the Norwegian Constitution, in order for the king to accede to the throne, he has to make the following pledge. I promise and swear that I will govern the Kingdom of Norway in accordance with the Constitution. Similarly, Article 32 of the Dutch Constitution requires that the king shall swear or promise allegiance to the Constitution and that he will faithfully discharge his duties. The remaining monarchies in Europe are truly constitutional, insofar as they are subordinate to the policies which they purport to represent. By stark contrast, the British monarchy stands not only above democracy, but above the law itself. Indeed, they like to think they are the law, inasmuch as they do whatever they please, including accumulating wealth without paying a penny in tax. Seen in this context, the British royal family constitutes Europe's largest imperial monarchy, apparently impervious to the vicissitudes of politics and history. It doesn't stop there, as even their upkeep far exceeds that of their European counterparts. The decadence and greed of the British monarchy puts European monarchies, indeed monarchies across the world, to shame. As for palaces, for example, the Spanish, Dutch and Danish royal families each have access to only two palaces. The House of Windsor, meanwhile, occupies 15 state residences, and that figure excludes privately owned estates like Balmoral Castle and Sandringham House. Monarchies around the world are adapting fast to political developments, if only to ensure their survival in an age of forensic scrutiny. Japan, which credibly claims to be the oldest monarchy in the world, is leading the way by trying to create as much distance as possible between the royal family and public expenditure. Prince Akashino, who is next in line to succeed Emperor Naruhito, announced that the royal family should cover the expense of succession ceremony from its own funds, as opposed to relying on the state treasury to cover the costs. This is a world away from the dreamscape occupied by Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and entourage. Despite their vast wealth, the royals make liberal use of public resources for their own pleasure and comfort. For instance, Prince William, who many believe will be the next king as Charles may abdicate in favour of his oldest son, once used a military helicopter to fly to a stag party. By the same token, the royals are not shy of using fabulously wealthy people's private resources either. In 2018, the American actor and producer George Clooney treated Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to a decadent holiday in Italy. Clooney reportedly flew the royal couple there in his private jet and gave them unfettered access to his luxurious 25-room villa. The question is, what, if anything, Clooney got in return for his extraordinary generosity? When the scandal about the couple's penchant for private jets first broke out, some observers were puzzled as to why the singer and songwriter Elton John had been so keen to leap to Harry and Meghan's defence. The answer may lie in the fact that the royal family uses its wealth and privilege to cultivate famous and influential types, exactly for such occasions when it needs to polish up its public image. Modern Britain is a country of contrasts, not to mention deep contradictions. The dizzyingly complex mix of traditions, mores, and an apparently insatiable postmodern impulse has created a country that is hard to decipher, let alone fully understand. And so it is with the monarchy. On the surface, most Britons appear to support the antiquated institution, not just on the grounds of sentimentalism, but also good old-fashioned British pragmatism. And yet, the UK is home to a small but vocal Republican community.
I'm here to protest the unaccountable power of the Crown. What it symbolises, which is hereditary privilege, and the constitutional power that it still has.
We don't need that kind of icon. You know, much better icons are, you know, things like ideas like democracy and the equality of citizenship, and maybe someone chosen by us to represent us.
The fact of the matter is, there is no credible evidence or indication even that the British public wants to abolish the monarchy, except for very cosmetic changes to the monarchy and only to placate public anger, never to reform the monarchy itself. Based on this clear political reality, the British monarchy is set to survive the 21st century, perhaps with little, if any, substantial change. But a parallel development points to the diminution of the UK's role in the world, perhaps even the breakup of the UK itself, as evidenced by the strengthening independence movement in Scotland and, to a lesser extent, Wales. As Britain becomes more parochial, the rest of the world is likely to care much less about the House of Windsor, and that may be a punishment worse than death for Britain's media-conscious royal family.
In the limelight.
The emergence of Giorgia Meloni as the new Prime Minister of Italy brings to everybody's mind the return of fascism to Italy. Critics believe the United States has opened the door for the return of fascism to Italy. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the second part. In this regard, Intercept wrote, Hillary Clinton made some embarrassing comments about the then forthcoming election of Giorgia Meloni as Italy's first woman prime minister. The former Secretary of State said the election of the first woman prime minister in a country always represents a break with the past, and that is certainly a good thing. Clinton has been rightly pilloried. After all, she was talking about the leader of the fascist Brothers of Italy party, the most extreme right-wing party to govern Italy since Benito Mussolini's dictatorship. Meloni claimed victory in a recent general election with considerable ease, leading a far-right coalition that now holds a significant majority in both Italy's houses of parliament. Whatever break from the past, having a woman leader signals Meloni would also represent continuity with Italy's darkest episode. Historian Ruth Ben-Ghiat noted in The Atlantic, and the continuance is very real. The Brothers of Italy's direct forebears, the neo-fascist Italian social movement, was formed by supporters of Duke IV after Second World War. The idea that a woman leader opens doors for other women, as Clinton suggested, is of course laughable. That's especially true when that leader is a fascist, keen to stop inequalities and do away with employment quotas that favor women, quite literally shuttering women in the nuclear home, while locking out immigrant women from Italy's body politic altogether. The media got this right much of the time, giving prominent billing to Meloni's far-right nationalism, but numerous English-language headlines focus solely on her being Italy's first woman prime minister. It's tempting to say that her position as a woman leader should be considered irrelevant, given her and her party's vile anti-immigrant, nationalist, and racist politics. But ignoring her womanhood misses some crucial points about her political ideology. Being a woman, a white woman, that is not in conflict with Meloni's fascism. White supremacy has always relied on active enforcement by white women, particularly when it comes to upholding racist, pro-natalist narratives. The website of Common Dreams wrote, in Italy, the sea is unfortunately contaminated and increasingly filled with plastic pollution. The climate crisis is creating havoc with ever more extreme weather conditions by the day. Floods, droughts, fires and extreme heat are the new normal. The political leadership is leading the country in the opposite direction of where it needs to go. Profits from the weapons makers, profits for the fossil fuel producers, and the insanity of nuclear power still dominate across the political spectrum. The United States dictates the politics in this subordinated outpost of the empire. Thousands of people migrating from extreme and deadly conditions in Africa, Asia, and the West Asian region die each year trying to reach Europe from across the Mediterranean. Instead of acting as a neutral party and demanding a pathway for a negotiated peace in Ukraine, the Italian government is a pawn on the American chessboard, ready to declare checkmate on the climate and on the future. While visiting Italy and the Venice Film Festival a month back, Hillary Clinton said in an interview with the Italian national newspaper Corriere della Sera that Meloni being elected would be a positive thing. Clinton said that any time a woman is elected to a position of power, it is a step forward for women around the world. A fitting statement coming from the woman who brought Americans Donald Trump with her campaign's pathetic Pied Piper strategy to elevate what they thought was the weakest candidate. And this is a fitting conclusion as the United States regime has effectively opened the door for fascism's return into Italy. The Greek Keeper wrote in its website, the rise of far-right politician Giorgia Meloni has left many outside Italy asking how her brand of what many argue is fascism can achieve such prominence in a country that has experienced life under the dictatorship of Benito Mussolini. The answer can be traced back to a recent normalization of reactionary politics. In truth, the existence of a far-right government in Italy is not entirely without precedent. In the post-war era between 1994 and 2011, especially labeled center-right alliance consisting of Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia, various iterations of a small Christian Democratic or centrist wing, Umberto Bossi's Northern League, and Gianfranco Fini's National Alliance governed Italy four times. The National Alliance was the predecessor party to Meloni's Brothers of Italy. Berlusconi takes a revisionist view of Mussolini's